I am Charlene Squires. Welcome to our masterclass presentation for today. Okay. Any questions so far? Any questions? Okay. All right, our first presenter will be Steve Hutchinson. Are you ready, Steve?
Yes, excuse me. Yes, I am.
Okay, perfect. Have at it.
Okay. Share my screen.
And everyone did clock in, right? Just want to make sure I get nervous that people forget to clock in.
Can see everything. My mic
Yes.
is ready. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, so as I get started, we're going to take a closer look at my HTML, CSS, and JavaScript journey, my personal journey. HTML, CSS, JavaScript is the trio that powers the magic behind the scenes. Think of them as the architects quietly working behind the curtain to create the online world we navigate. Together, they weave this intricate tapestry that forms the backbone of our digital experiences. It's pretty cool to think about how these languages collaborate to build the dynamic landscapes we encounter on the web. So let's delve into the heart of web development. So, embarking on our journey, we first encounter HTML, a foundational pillar and a true backbone of the web. HTML, or Hypertext Markup Language, is the elemental force that orchestrates the very structure of digital existence. Picture it as the architect's blueprint, meticulously crafting the skeletal framework for every web page through a symphony of tags and elements. In essence, HTML is the language spoken by websites to convey their essence to the browsers. It weaves a narrative of content using tags as the building blocks that form the intricate tapestry of information. These tags define the structure and hierarchy, creating a seamless flow of data that underpins the core structure of every web page. As we venture further into the realms of web development, our next protagonist is CSS, the enchanting, cascading style sheets. Think of CSS as the virtuoso artist poised to breathe life into the structural canvas painted by HTML. It is the creative force that transcends mere functionality, orchestrating a symphony of visual elements that captivate and engage. CSS is the maestro of presentation and layout, orchestrating the choreography of elements on our website. It's the magic wand that transformed the raw structure provided by HTML into visually stunning and cohesive designs. Just as an artist meticulously selects colors and shapes to create a masterpiece, CSS adds that extra layer of finesse to our web pages. And then we have JavaScript. Oh, JavaScript. The dynamic powerhouse of web development, JavaScript stands as the unrivaled force breathing life into the static realms of web pages and infusing them with an irresistible vitality. JavaScript, often hailed as the virtuoso of interactivity, transcends the boundaries of conventional coding. Consider JavaScript as the maestro conducting an orchestra of web elements, orchestrating a symphony of responsiveness and engagement. Its proficiency lies in its ability to transform static web pages into living, breathing entities that respond to user input with finesse. It's the magic wand that turns the digital canvas into an interactive masterpiece, forging a connection between users and the virtual world. As a programming language, JavaScript powers an array of interactive features that embellish the web landscape. From dynamic content updates and seamless transitions and user-triggered events, JavaScript is the unsung hero behind the scenes, working tirelessly to enhance the overall user experience. So we're going to go into my personal journey into coding. Well, when I decided to join Purdue, I didn't know, I just needed a second job. Even though I have a good job, I just feel like I needed something to bring in extra money. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I always had like a knack for computers and coding. I basically always wanted to be a hacker in a sense. Well, an ethical hacker. Let me put that out there. And so I signed up for coding and I just jumped into Purdue because it was the first online school that kept popping up during my research. So I'll share with you a glimpse into the personal odyssey that defies my coding journey. It all commenced with a fascination for intricate world of hacking. However, as time unfolded and my academic pursuits led me to Purdue, the trajectory of my coding journey took an unexpected turn, evolving into a profound interest in web development. The initial stages were not without their challenges, a landscape of daunting coding obstacles that tested the mettle of my resolve. Navigating through the complexities of algorithms and syntax, I found myself on a precipice of a vast and unexplored realm. It was in the face of these challenges that I discovered an innate curiosity propelling me to further explore and understand the intricacies that lay beneath the surface of lines of code. Purdue, with its rich academic environment, became the crucible where my fascination transformed into a deeper passion for web development. The structured learning environment, coupled with hands-on experiences, provided the fertile ground for my coding skills. It was here that I began to realize the profound impact of coding, the ability to translate ideas into tangible, interactive experiences on a digital canvas. So I didn't like the way that my web development teacher was teaching the class. And I felt like I didn't retain enough information, and I'm a person that I don't like to move on until I understand something. So I made the mistake of taking the first summer off school to join this Codecademy bootcamp. And even though it wasn't, how could I put it? It wasn't as strict as I needed it to be. It still helped me understand. It gave me more of a hands-on experience. So I signed up for Codecademy and I started learning HTML and CSS a little bit more and a little bit of JavaScript. So in the pursuit of fortifying my coding prowess, I embarked on a transformative chapter by enrolling. This decision became a cornerstone in my coding journey. In my coding journey, marking a pivotal point where challenges were not just faced but conquered, and where frustration metamorphed into unwavering determination. Codecademy's bootcamp of learning and skill refinement provided me with a structured and immersive environment to deepen my understanding of coding principles. The curriculum, meticulously designed to navigate through the intricacies and various programming languages and concepts, became the compass guiding me through the vast and dynamic landscape of coding. The challenges encountered during the bootcamp were not mere obstacles, but opportunities for growth. Each line of code written, each problem solved, was a step closer to building confidence in my abilities. It was a journey of perseverance where frustration transformed into a driving force propelling me forward. Let's embark on a captivating journey delving into my venture into website building. This venture was fueled by a compelling vision, the creation of an e-commerce site that would not only meet but exceed expectations. Little did I know that this endeavor would become a crucible of trial and error, where each challenge was a stepping stone in the intricate dance of web development. Inspiration served as the compass guiding my initial forays into crafting this digital realm. The vision of an e-commerce site with its dynamic interface and seamless user experience spurred me to traverse the uncharted territories of coding and design. However, as with any creative undertaking, the path was laden with intricacies, and coding in particular provided to be a formidable challenge. The journey into website building was let's say it was something that I didn't expect to be so vast and intricate. Adapting and refining the art web development, coding intricacies became a puzzle wanting to be solved. Each line of code an integral piece in the larger canvas of the envisioned e-commerce site. Every hurdle encountered was an opportunity to expand my knowledge base, to adapt my coding methodologies, and to refine the craft of building an immersive digital experience. So, I decided the only way for me to understand coding is to practice by building my own website. So, for the fact that I really didn't have that mentor to guide me in the right direction, I went to YouTube and I started watching YouTube videos and practicing that way. Embarking on a journey of continuous learning, I turned to the vast expanse of YouTube tutorials to deepen my understanding of web development, specifically focusing on the creation of an e-commerce site. In this enlightening chapter, a six-part tutorial became my guide, unraveling the intricacies of structure and media queries and marking a pivotal step in my evolving proficiency in web development. YouTube, a treasure trove of educational content, became my virtual classroom. The six-part tutorial provided a structured roadmap, guiding me through the intricate process of creating an e-commerce site. Each segment became a building block, adding layers of knowledge to my understanding of web development. Structure, the fundamental backbone of any website, was dissected and explained, demystifying the intricate relationships between HTML elements and their visual representation on a digital canvas. The tutorial meticulously navigated through nuances of organizing content, creating a cohesive flow, and ensuring a seamless user experience. In the face of challenges, my journey in web development marked a crucial milestone. Mastering HTML, as I navigated through coding intricacies, HTML became the sturdy foundation of the project. So I'll briefly explain ex let's briefly explore the HTML elements used, forming the resilient backbone of the website structure. HTML transformed from tags and attributes into a dynamic tool, allowing me to articulate the design vision seamlessly. Structural elements, form elements, divs, spans, and semantic elements played a symphonic role in shaping the user interface, creating a harmonious and visual appealing structure. Mastering HTML was not just a technical feat, but a testament to my resilience, adaptation, and refining the artistry of web development. So this here is the design of the e-commerce site I decided to build. The evolution of the design was a captivating narrative of creative transformation. With each iteration, the visual landscape of the project underwent a remarkable evolution, guided by a collaborative spirit with my client, who in this instance was my girlfriend. My girlfriend has a candle company, and I asked her, can I build her website for her instead of her using something like WordPress to give me the practice that I needed. The interplay of ideas, feedback, and shared inspiration became the driving force behind the refinement of the aesthetic. It was a journey fueled by mutual commitment to perfection, where adaptation and meticulous refinement were the keystone. The design, like a canvas, unfolded and adapted until seamlessly embodied the shared vision that we had set out to achieve. So I decided to, I don't want to say make the mistake, but I wanted to create a mega nav bar. And I spent almost 2 months, probably longer, trying to make this mega nav bar work correctly. And it ended up working through trial and error, a lot of errors. And it was so frustrating. I literally felt like Neo in the Matrix, and these agents just stopping me from being great. So, but it's coming along. So amidst the intricate web development journey, notable challenges came to the forefront, casting a spotlight on the complexities surrounding the mega nav bar. This particular design element, known for its intricacy, became a focal point that demanded a meticulous examination of details and an elevated level of problem-solving prowess. Navigating through the intricacies of the mega nav bar wasn't merely a technical challenge, but a testament to the depth of the development journey. So tackling JavaScript and the side nav and cart. I had a big problem with the side cart, because every time I displayed it, it would push everything over. So I had to debug and find out where I was making the mistakes. And this, I'm not too good at JavaScript, so I had to do a lot of research on what was going wrong. And ChatGPT helped me a lot with finding coding's parts of the code that I couldn't see what was giving a problem. And it ended up working out. Lo and behold, these are just placeholders, just for the pictures until I get new pictures. But as you can see, it's starting to shape up and come out pretty decent. Venturing into the realm of JavaScript marked a transformative phase where I seamlessly integrated dynamic elements such as the side nav and cart into the project. The process was not merely a coding endeavor, but a meticulous journey emphasizing the imperative for ongoing enhancement of JavaScript skills. The incorporation of these dynamic elements served as a testament to the intricate dance between functionality and user interaction, underlining the need for a continuous commitment to refining JavaScript proficiency. Join me as we... So the journey of hard coding is a testament to the unwavering belief in one's ability to navigate the intricate landscape of programming challenges. It's a narrative of persistence where the coder faces hurdles head on, armed with the conviction that every line of code is a step closer to mastery. The challenges inherent in hard coding are not roadblocks, but milestones in a journey of continuous learning and evolution. As one delves into the complexities of hard coding, each obstacle becomes an opportunity to hone problem-solving skills and unravel intricacies of code logic. The process is not without its moments of frustration and uncertainty, but it is within these moments that we, as coders, discover the resilience needed to overcome challenges. Belief in the ability to decipher the intricacies of hard coding fuels the determination to persist, to debug, and to optimize until the code reflects the envisioned outcome. In closing, this expedition into the realm of web development stands as a transformative odyssey. From the initial allure of coding to the mastery of HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, the crux lies in the ethos of continuous learning and adaptation. Gratitude extends to the mentors, leads, and colleagues which have been guiding beacons in this journey. As I conclude this chapter, I extend an invitation for your questions and discussions, inviting you to join me in navigating the ever-exciting world of web development. Thank you.
Wow, that's really nice. I enjoyed your Matrix pictures there, because I was a big fan of Matrix.
Yeah, me too. I'm still a fan.
Yeah. Well, I still like it.
Yeah.
You can still watch it over and over and over. But anyway, but yeah, coding is not easy. I've done some in the past, a long time ago, but lately I haven't gotten back into coding. But I did try Python a little bit, which I liked, but I didn't finish it. So I was like, go back to square one again, because by the time I do it, I'll forget what I learned. So I have to go back and relearn. Yeah.
Yeah, it's been such a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But it's fun when you actually see your visions come to life on a computer. So it keeps you going.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. There was a class that I took when I was doing my bachelor's, and we had to create our own website for something. So what I chose to do was a website for advertising my a restaurant that I would like to open in my husband's hometown. So so it was kind of cool. I got to use some, you know, HTML and, you know, CSS and, you know, designing it, make sure the colors are all right and all that stuff. So I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, any questions for Steve, guys? You guys are so quiet. All right, Alexis, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, everyone. So just a quick question. Where can I buy one of your girlfriends? Well, first of all, amazing presentation. I loved, like, the Matrix and, like, entrepreneurship. And I want to know, where can I get one of your girlfriend's candles?
Well, I would say that you can DM me on a private DM, and I can let you know exactly all the flavors, scents that she has, and whatever the price is, she'll just mail it out to you, and yeah, go from there. Cause she don't have a virtual shop yet. She do like events and pop ups and stuff like that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right. Thanks. Yeah. Thank you. No problem. Great job.
Thanks.
Oh, sorry about that. Any other questions for Steve?
No.
Nothing but candles? Okay, that's fine. All right, so our next speaker tonight is Nicholas.
Yep, Wait. That'll be me.
Perfect.
All right, and you all can hear me pretty well?
Yes.
Okay, and you can see my screen now as well, correct?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So my presentation is going to be how to take the human out of human error. This just focuses on cybersecurity basics. It's going to be a short presentation, honestly. Maybe one slide, who knows? Doctors kind of hate this one thing that I kind of have a secret tip for you guys. So here, step one. Oh no. Okay, step one, just become a robot. So there's not going to be any human error if you're a robot. But on to a more serious note, why are we the weakest link in cybersecurity? So according to a data breach incident report, humans account for 74% of all data breaches. Why might this happen? So we can be flippant when it comes to rules and policies, and we can also believe that we're immune to any trouble that may happen, like, oh, that'll never happen to me. And then if not everybody's buying in, so like say the CEO or like a vice president doesn't really believe in attending cybersecurity meetings or adhering to those rules, not everybody's going to buy in as well, especially lower on the totem. And then there's also a human nature aspect to it and a lot of psychology behind this as well. So we as people, we're kind of trusting by nature. And so we're kind of prone to falling for social engineering attempts. Like if somebody says they need help or need something specific, we typically want to reach out and help them out. All right. So how can we become stronger? So everything right here is just, this is what we're going to talk about later on. But so to begin, you start off with some training, some cybersecurity awareness training. After that, you go through retraining every 4 months, I would say. And how can you get people to buy in? So you can offer incentives. So I know when I was at the VA, if we ever completed training or had no incidents regarding cybersecurity, we'd get a half day. And, you know, everybody likes time off. Simulations as well. So like you put what you've learned into practice with these simulations, like say somebody will send out a fake email. Can I have this information? This is a simulation. You apply what you've learned and you do what you see fit. Back to the psychology of cybersecurity. You need to make it a habit. We as people, we like to make things convenient or easy. And sometimes cybersecurity is nitty gritty and you have to put a lot of time in the small details. And that comes in the form of password management as well. Like we'll stick to a template typically. Next is authentication and authorization as well. That's another thing that you want to make a habit because it may not be the most convenient thing and it takes extra steps and nobody likes extra steps. And overall, this is just going to be understanding human nature. All right, so on to the awareness training and retraining. So what makes a good training program? Well, it begins with executive buy-in. So the people at the top have to agree to this training. They'll fund it. They'll make sure that you get everything you need to make the presentation or the training a success. And into the content of the training, you want to identify risks and their potential impact just to get people to buy in as well. So you can tell people not to do something, but unless they really understand why, they're just going to be like, okay, yeah, I won't do that. But if they understand what could happen and what stands to like fall or what risks occur, then they'll have a better understanding and probably be more reasonable to adhere to those security policies. And then you also want to keep everyone engaged. You can't just have like a death by PowerPoint or like a very monotone, serious talk about why you shouldn't open emails that ask for your personal information. And then last but not least, keep up to date on best practices. So don't, you know, research something from like 98 where it's like, oh, if somebody's trying to dial in, like we don't do that anymore. And then also another thing to think about this, we're all, not all, but a majority of us are in cybersecurity here. So the onus could be on us later on in our careers to give a presentation like this or to find out the whys and hows and keeping people adhering to cybersecurity policies. And then, so how often should you retrain or refresh someone's knowledge? Well, according to a recent study done at the USINIC SOUPS, it's a security conference, 4 months is typically the sweet spot in how often these refreshers should be done. Okay, and on to password management. So this is the big one. It's really simple. Everybody knows the template. You got a word, then you got a symbol, and then you got some numbers. Is that a strong template for a password? Unfortunately, no. So on the right side of the screen here, you'll see an image by Hive Systems. And this is how long it would take a hacker to brute force your password in 2023. So as you can see, the lower numbers and the less unique symbols it uses, the easier it is to crack. But once you get higher up, maybe say 12, and then you start adding some numbers, lowercase letters, symbols, it becomes more complex to brute force, and that's what you want. You want a password that's hard to crack, and it doesn't necessarily have to take a lot of thought. You can just vomit onto a Microsoft Word document and create a password that way. And then there's also, like, if you can, you can maybe try and add a space to your password as well, because typically nobody's going to brute force or check for a space in a password. And let's say you don't really want to put in the effort, or you just want to stick to a simple password, or you don't want to take the time to keep re-entering passwords, you can use a password manager. They can create strong passwords for you, and you can safely store them and never have to remember them. You just have your password manager open when you want to log in, copy paste, and you're done. But I mean, that is to say that these are also susceptible to getting hacked as well, and somebody can get this information. But if they really wanted to go that far, maybe they've earned it at that point. And then, like I said earlier, you can also just revisit the Stone Age. You don't have to use a password manager. You can also just write it down on a notebook on your person, just alphabet, symbol, number, soup onto that paper, and keep it safe at all times. All right, authentication and authorization. Do you have to get a text? Sometimes you'd want to. So we all love convenience, but is that cementing us as a whole as the weakest link in cybersecurity? And I think it does play a part. So setting up multi-factor authentication, which is just an extra step after you log in. You guys know it. It's receiving a text, getting a push notification. It's simple. All you got to do is download an app like Google Authenticator. Some schools use it as well. And then you can also set up push notifications to a personal device. I know a lot of banking apps do this. It's like you can have it send a push notification to a device that you own. And then there's always the text or the phone calls as well. All right, so how can this help? So if a hacker does have access to your password, well, guess what? If you don't have multi-factor authentication, they're in and they can get access to anything they want on that account. And then if you do set it up, this is another thing, like the psychology of it. It establishes that the user is willing to take the necessary steps to not be the weakest link. And we're going to segue on into the next slide, because this is a habit. You want to establish that habit and understand human nature. What's in it for me? So segueing from the previous slide, it's a habit. So if we establish something as a habit, we're more prone to do it. So practicing stronger cybersecurity often becomes a habit. We take the steps, we're better at cybersecurity, we may not be the weakest link. All right, so what else can we do to benefit the human nature for this? So we can incentivize people, you know, complete the training, pass simulations, not have any incidents. Boom, you get a half day, anything really, pizza party, maybe a rock or something, who knows. And then you also have to make it cool, you know, make sure everybody's doing it. Like I said earlier at the beginning, you want the buy-in from the top down. Because if everybody's taking it serious, you won't have people lower on the totem pole going, well, so-and-so doesn't really care, so why should I? Right. And then that just sums up. So if everybody has bought into it, there's no room for flippant behavior, really, when it comes to cyber threats. Like, oh, I'm not going to fall for this. This isn't going to happen to me. All right. Proper browsing etiquette. Local singles, click here. All right. So this should be obvious to everyone at this point. But, you know, don't click on everything you see. And this is a really elementary take on this. But I think the most serious issue people have with browsing etiquette at work is using their personal accounts. So like their email, Spotify, I mean, maybe Pandora if they still use it, going on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So all those can compromise the network that you're on, because if you have, say, you've signed in to Spotify on your work computer, There are some instances where, just because you've signed into a personal account, that the organization has been compromised, and that will be touched up on later. And later is right now. So in 2022, Cisco had an employee's personal account compromised, which included VPN credentials. So that hacker got access to the VPN to get onto their Cisco sites. So now that hacker had access to everything within that organization, and they could, set up shop. All right, and this is a continuation, but this will be including devices, personal accounts, and you. So I know some people work from home, and you've heard of bring your own device. And I think that's always a no-go, especially if your work will monitor what goes on in that device. And then in certain cases, maybe it's a device designated for work and work only, then maybe that should be fine. But so say you set up your personal laptop as a bring your own device, I would just avoid doing that, because while you're at work or on your work's network, using that device and anything that's ever been on it. So like, say you've logged into something, you've accepted cookies on some certain website, maybe it's something you've missed, but if you're using that on your work's personal network or like their intranet, you could be making them susceptible to an attack that you may not be aware of. And then also it's a matter of privacy. So you don't really want your work to have like access to your own phone, you know, or your laptop, what you're doing, what you're watching, you know. All right. And next, we report anything fishy. So this also goes hand in hand with what your training taught you. You'll see what to look out for in email. So like, somebody's asking for something too personal, you don't know that person, so you'd report it. You'd also check for like fake emails. You check for, you know, anybody suspicious that you don't really see at work. I know I watched a conference a while ago, and it was this guy. He would visit people's workplaces, and he would always ask testing questions about if he could access their computer because he needed to do something. And of course, a lot of people willing to help out were like, oh, yeah, sure, no problem, go ahead. And, you know, that's just something you don't do, especially when you have some amount of privilege into your organization, because they can gain access to what they shouldn't have. And again, this is another psychology behind it, but do we really want to tell on people, and do we really want to turn someone in? And I think this is something that we should have to get over, because when I was at the VA, so when you want to go into the building, you have to scan a card, and then it opens the door. And the policy was that everybody has to scan to open the door. But if you were, say, maybe 20 feet in front of somebody and you knew they were behind you, you'd scan the door. It would open up for you. You'd look at the person behind you and just walk away, not holding the door open for them, because that's against the policy. And that's one of the things. Like, you don't want to be a bad person, but you have to adhere to those policies. So you don't have to always be polite to everyone, especially when it infringes on those policies. And like I said, anything suspicious emails, suspicious people, calls, any vendors that are suspicious, just make sure to report that to any security analyst, and they'll get and deal with it. And then again, if something seems out of place, don't be afraid to call it out. Don't be afraid to be the bad person, because sometimes that could help out your company or your organization. All right, and second to last slide. A good way to keep this behavior up and make it a habit is to continuously monitor and evaluate. Are you using your best practices? Are you keeping up with, you know, updating your passwords, using complex passwords, using multi-factor authentication? Have you had any refreshers in the past 4 months? And then there's always like, have you done something you shouldn't have? Like, have you been careful when you've been reading emails, sending emails out, making sure that the wrong audience doesn't receive something they should not? And then also, is that Nigerian prince really in need of that PII to save his village? All right, and before I go, enjoy this segue to my references. right. And any questions?
Good job.
Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Put very simply and all. But there were some instances that reminded me of things. Like, for instance, I think I shared it in cybersecurity. But a coworker of mine in the one large company, she had her iPod and she plugged it into her computer, which almost brought down the whole network because there was a malware attached.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think that's
That was really bad when I heard about that. I was like, wow. So when I came in, everyone's like, did you hear about this or did you hear? And I was like, no, I haven't. So they were telling me a story. I was like, oh, wow. And she was still there. So she heard the stories many times over, I bet.
Oh, yeah. The VA is big on that, too. They don't allow you to plug anything in that has its own memory. So, like, if you wanted to use, like, a mouse or, like, a headset, you had to make sure it was, like, as bare bones as possible.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Definitely. And then with the bring your own device, the company I worked for, when they sent us home, they gave us their device instead of our own. Because if you bring your own device, they will wipe everything out on your computer, except the, I don't know, the Windows thing.
Right, the program files mostly.
Yeah, but everything else will be wiped. So it's not something that you really want to bring your own device.
Oh, yeah, especially with privacy. I would not want anybody getting access to, like, conversations I have with, other people.
Definitely. Definitely. That's why work emails, always be careful what you say in those emails, because a couple of my coworkers got in trouble. Well, more than two, but they got in trouble and they were criticizing another worker in the same department. And she found out because somehow she got a hold of the emails. And she printed that, they printed it all out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you really need to be careful because that actually does happen. If you criticize anyone, I always tell people, do not do that.
Do it over your personal device.
Well, the thing is, they watch all the emails, the company does. So they read everything. So. But they didn't, I don't know how it got to the printer, that part. I was gone for a few days. And so when I came back, I heard all this rumble in the office, and come to find out that's what happened. They found out those emails. So they got in trouble. One person, he was a temp. And of course, guess what happened? Goodbye, temp.
Yep.
Yeah. So he didn't, he couldn't work for, that company ever again. So that was on the record. So that's not good. But anyway, the other people didn't get didn't get fired by it, but they were, given a big talking to, I guess. I don't know. But anyway, I just thought I'd throw that out. So work emails are always,
work emails always be about work, nothing else.
Right, but not criticism of work. If you have to criticize something, don't say it. that's my experience anyway. Don't say it. Because once you say it out loud or type it in your email format, whatever, it can become public.
Right, especially if they can keylog your device as well. They can see what you typed, even if they didn't, explicitly keep it in the document or the email.
True. Yeah. So if you say something like that, you might as well do it on your own personal devices and not work work devices. Yeah, I found out, you know, it through experience, that's a, you know, bad way to handle it. So, because I knew something was going to happen when they kept criticizing. But anyway, long story. Any questions? Do you guys have any questions for Nick or Nicholas?
No.
Nope. Okay. Going on then, our next speaker is Alexis. Are you ready?
Yes. Hello. Yes. Good evening.
Good. I've been looking forward to this one.
Yeah. So. Just give me a thumbs up if you could, like, or off your own voice, just so you could see the slide. And just let me know if you just see the slide, like, not anything else. All right, cool. So, my internet. Okay, great. My internet is a little weird, so I hope everything goes well. Okay. So, hello, everyone. My name is Alexis, and today I will be presenting on the roles of IT in e-commerce. So, I chose this topic because I am researching how I can integrate entrepreneurship, e-commerce, and cybersecurity into one blend of different experiences and projects I can enjoy throughout my entrepreneurship journey. For me, it makes the most sense to talk about how cybersecurity and e-commerce work alongside each other to contribute to the various technology environments, as well as the business environments too. As cybersecurity threats continue to increase, so does the need for the world of e-commerce to be more aware and intentional when practicing cybersecurity for their businesses. So for the overview, we will be reviewing what e-commerce is, how information technology and cybersecurity relates to e-commerce, cybersecurity risks in e-commerce, mitigating cyber threats in e-commerce, as well as final thoughts on cybersecurity's role in e-commerce, references, and then questions. E-commerce. Let's dive into learning about how e-commerce and IT work together. Okay, so what is e-commerce? The E in e-commerce translates to electronic commerce. E-commerce is the ability to purchase and sell online via the internet. E-commerce is considered to be a globally important key development in the field of business. Also, it is the key that changed marketplaces, commercial methods, and economies worldwide over the years, with more digital enhancements and more digital additions to the e-commerce space. It has transcended the shopping experience into multiple versions of virtual platforms to provide virtual shopping experiences for customers. E-commerce is typically favored more due to its convenience and ability to be accessed or practiced globally. And it's usually favored more than going shopping in person, going to a brick and mortar building. So how does IT and e-commerce with each other? They are good friends because one cannot work without the other. It's not operate without the counterpart, its digital electronic counterpart. It is crucial that cybersecurity systems, softwares, and techniques are employed throughout the protection and maintenance of e-commerce websites. It's a must for all e-commerce businesses and/or entrepreneurs. Cybersecurity is vital for the protection of e-commerce websites from scams, hackers, and any other various cybersecurity threats. All businesses should establish a foundational understanding in how cybersecurity practices and enhance the security of their websites. It's also important that entrepreneurs have their own website And this is to also include their personal blogs, personal domains, and social media profiles. So when I say that it's important for entrepreneurs that they have their own website, I mean, if they have their own website, they should make sure that they are following the proper cybersecurity policies and procedures if they're not being hosted on a website such as Shopify or Wix. They just make sure all the basic components are put in place. It shouldn't be too challenging. All businesses must ensure they are using the correct security measures to prevent data breaches from damaging their reputation. E-commerce businesses must also know how to properly and efficiently respond to a security breach, which is why going over information and presentations like this is really important. Cyber risks in e-commerce. There are a plethora of risks in the landscape of e-commerce. Some of the threats are phishing, DDoS attacks, malware, cross-site scripting, also known as the actual like S and the two S's, and e-skimming. So, phishing. For phishing, customers are often tricked into false instructions, which can lead to data breaches, and this typically occurs right before malware infection. To go further more about phishing, phishing is one of the main attacks that occur for most businesses, especially in e-commerce. Customers of these e-commerce businesses are always at risk for being targeted by social engineering attacks. They are the types of attacks that use fraudulent messages to trick customers into giving their personally identifiable information, aka PII, such as account numbers, credit card numbers, and passwords. Cybercriminals can then use this stolen information to gain unauthorized access to users' accounts, which is kind of similar to credential stuffing, except credential stuffing is more about brute force attacks, whereas this situation is more about being able to get the information in an unauthorized manner. Also, phishing is typically the precursor to a malware infection, as I had previously mentioned. Distributed denial of service attacks, DDoS attacks, are used to disrupt business ecosystems by overloading their servers with requests, with multiple requests. The attacks are usually streamlined by botnets. So underneath DDoS attacks, I have botnet core, because in this case, the botnet machines are the core of the action. They're the core of the DDoS attacks. They're like the main, that's just how I perceive it to be. And also botnets are the sole operator for infecting devices on the network, leading to the target device being overwhelmed with multiple requests. This can be very bad for e-commerce systems because an attack like this could result in such extreme loss, such as having to completely shut down an e-commerce website. That would be excruciating. If I had an e-commerce website and that unfortunately happened, you'd have to start all over again. And e-skimming can lead to fraud. So I have this e-commerce video here. Just a few things that I would love to point out. I'll say it before the video. So we're going to stop at certain points, not too long. We're going to go over phishing, e-commerce websites and organizations, and how they will never send a link to their customers regarding PII. And then we're also going to review a section about SQL injections and basically how SQL injections are an increasing potential threat, and more e-commerce businesses must be informed about these potential threats that may arise, such as hosting your website via Shopify, since Shopify uses MySQL for their databases to store lots of big data. But I'm going to play the video, and let's just give me a thumbs up if you can hear it.
Need to protect.
Okay, great. So I'm going to pause it. Just bear with me. I'm going to go to I'm going to go here.
This time it's because
okay, so that portion, I just have a note that I wanted to say about that. Yeah, if you are a customer and you're getting an email from your favorite e-commerce store and they're asking something about like PII, that's definitely a scam. They're never, ever, ever, ever going to reach out to you unless you yourself went in on your website or on the website and requested to, you say, forgot password or forgot email. That's most like the most realistic time or moment that you would get an email from that person. Now, just want to go over SQL injections.
SQL injection. Repeat.
Okay, so I'll stop it right there. Because the note that I have is, so like they said, keep an eye out for malicious activity. And I think it's crucial for e-commerce businesses to these things so they know what to look for in terms of the unusual locations and the multiple shipping addresses. Moving on to the next few sections. So now we will be continuing with discussions on mitigating and minimizing threats, as well as why information technology and cybersecurity are needed in e-commerce. And I like this GIF here. I think it went really well with the theme. Okay, so mitigating cyber threats in e-commerce. It is important to establish a traffic's baseline for e-commerce websites. This means that businesses need to keep an eye out for unusual activities, just like it was mentioned in the video. And also, here's a screenshot of that complete order. I just wanted to stop at the multiple shipping addresses because I don't want to go past the time too much. Businesses need to keep an eye out for unusual activities, such as customer creating an order with multiple shipping addresses, like in the video. Third-party risk management. It can be a threat to e-commerce websites because other suppliers, vendors, etc. are all potential weaknesses within the supply chain. There are security solutions for e-commerce websites to securely and transparently work with third-party businesses. Online businesses must ensure that they are using the most updated SSL security certificates, SSL/TSL security certificates, especially since most e-commerce websites are going to be processing financial data anyways. The S and HTTPS provides a higher level of security, hence S, via encryption and verification of data transmissions. Organizations are encouraged to practice stronger password implementations. So for a stronger password implementation, the password created should be based on what that application is asking, like in terms of requirements, such as recommended characters, letters, or numbers. Also, backing up e-commerce store data, like for instance, if you have a Shopify store and they have all the database information stored somewhere and you're the admin and you have access to it, or if you need to reach out to Shopify, either way, you should still be able to back up your e-commerce store data just in case something were to happen on the website that you're hosting. Hopefully nothing happens, but just in case something were to happen, you would have your data backed up. And that would mean that you can potentially still keep the reputation of your e-commerce business. Whereas if something were to happen and all your data is gone, like you would lose a lot of money. You would have a negative ROI. It wouldn't be good. This is why I think this is another sector that is slowly going to be developing more, if not already. But e-commerce security is really important. So anyways, backing up e-commerce data is essential so the files can be stored somewhere safe in case a data breach happens. Also, educate customers on e-commerce security. So customers, just like employees, even though they're on the different sides of things, they're both needing to know more about e-commerce security and cybersecurity. And it's a great way to get closer with your customers and to help them protect their data. They will know that you are on their side. Also, cybersecurity awareness training can be a part of that too. You can, as a business owner, maybe send a weekly letter or a monthly newsletter, just reminding them about the cybersecurity threats that arise. It is recommended to perform e-commerce security simulations so retail companies can gauge the current security posture of that organization. This is part of the process of running multiple tests to examine and review how well the company responds to flaws and risks in the defense system that they have. In terms of defense layers, e-commerce security can be enhanced by employing multiple defense layers. What does that mean? That means that you can employ VPN, firewalls, two-factor authentication, and other layers to protect your e-commerce business. So, my final thoughts on cybersecurity's role in e-commerce. More concern on cyber affairs for e-commerce businesses. So I think that e-commerce businesses should dedicate some time into investing and learning more about security. That essentially translates to whoever is the owner of the e-commerce business, they're probably going to have to gather and garner another skill. They're going to have to understand the foundations of cybersecurity, especially if they want to survive in the digital space of selling products online. They should also learn how they can teach their customers to not be tricked into giving away their information. Also, I think it would be a great idea for e-commerce businesses to pick a day, perhaps, like I kind of just mentioned before, but more specifically, pick a day out of the month to promote the importance of knowing the different types of social engineering attacks that can occur. And also talking of, they can also do this through flyers or through email marketing. But yes, it's very important that these e-commerce businesses are more, e-commerce fraud, they're more specific in terms of like, hey, like you can, your credit card information can be stolen if you're not careful, and then that can lead to fraud, just like e-skimming. So, with that being said, here are my references, and thank you. Any questions?
Sorry, I raised my hand by mistake, but good job.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thanks.
And that's good. It's a good note about the Shopify. Because if their, you know, their databases with SQL is like not very safe.
Yes. Yes, exactly. They're still, through my research, I realized, I was like, wow, actually, like, even though Shopify is a really great store and a really great platform, it still has a lot of security, cybersecurity hurdles to overcome, just like many other websites. But yeah, Shopify is still developing.
Mm-hmm. True. It's good to know. Any questions? Pardon. Go ahead, David.
I'd started sort of years back in developing a whole, you know, website and e-commerce sort of site on my own, and I realize it's a mound of you know, work to even, let alone set up all of it, but even to manage all of those things, and then now that security should be a major concern too because of the threats. I'm just wondering, did you or anyone have any concerns about the services that we sort of like trust to sort of manage now these days? Like, you know, the, you know, service as a, what is it? A platform, software, whatever. And in fact, that if they are all up to date with all their security measures, I know you talked about Shopify. I mean, is that a concern? Is that with anyone?
Yes. I actually am going to go back and look at my PowerPoint slide because I thought I mentioned it, but I guess I didn't. It was something along the lines of third-party vendors. Did I mention anything about third-party vendors? Dang. My brain, I'm tired. Dang. Well, thank you for asking that question because I could have. I'm looking. Anyway, I'm not going to spend the time to look. But yes, I definitely have expressed my concerns about like the third party vendors, and I'm really trying to scramble to find it. But I basically just said something along the lines of like these companies, these e-commerce companies, are going to also need to be careful with third party. Oh yeah, I did mention it. Okay. I said something about third party. If you just bear with me, I just need to say it out loud. Third party risk management. Yeah. In mitigating cyber threats in e-commerce, I had said that the third party risk management can be a threat to e-commerce websites, because other suppliers, vendors, and providers are all potential weaknesses within the supply chain. So while that is a huge concern, there are security solutions for that. I think there's something called like UpVendor or something like that, which is another vendor for third-party security protection. But I hope I answered your question. But yeah, I'm definitely concerned about that for sure.
That's good. Great. Thank you.
No problem.
All right, any other questions for Alexis? You guys are so quiet. Quiet. It's one of those days, right, in the week. It's like, I'm tired. Okay.
I'm so tired.
I bet. All right. Our next presenter is David Brown. Go ahead, David.
Okay. Let me do this. I think I know sometimes this is a little harder for me. So I know I'm sharing my
screen. Yes. It's coming. We have computer forensic examination and law enforcement. Is that yours?
Yes.
Okay.
I should have the.
There you go.
That it?
Yeah. Well, this is, you know, when you're in the presenter mode, then the main screen comes up really big. Nice.
Okay, so we're good?
We're good.
Okay,
keep going. Cool.
Okay, all right, people. My name, again, to repeat, is David Brown, and I am presenting to you, as we see on this title slide, computer forensics examination. So part of it is, I think there is, we're going to get to kind of get an understanding that there are other entities that are involved. And what I put in here in law enforcement, and we might think of us as cybersecurity professionals on one hand, but there is a great deal of this work being done and have been done and needed because of technology advancements. You know, you hear about DNA and evidence. So we're going to go on to all of that, and then connect that with the justice and how it works in court, how you have to present that evidence, whether it's digital, and what we might think of when we think of CSI on television, physical evidence even. So that is all going to be the connection here. Digital connected with law enforcement, court, investigators, so on and so forth. So let's look at investigation and enforcement. In an era dominated by technology, digital evidence serves as a cornerstone in criminal investigations. And with the surge in cyber crimes, computer forensics plays a pivotal role in solving cases and prosecuting offenders, just like any other crime. Okay, so that's the realm of all of this is all intertwined together. The main message is that computer forensics is the key to unlocking digital mysteries, providing law enforcement with tools. Those are critical tools to navigate the complexities of modern crime, even. So we can see how it is needed in that sense as well. Digital and physical evidence. The tactics used in the crime scene investigation and the objectives of computer forensics are comparable. That is, computer forensics uncovers digital evidence, right? And to support investigators, and physical evidence is gathered to reconstruct events at a crime scene. You see some of the, whether there's the hard drive on one hand and might be noted as a bloody knife on the other hand. All evidence, right? The former involves gathering digital data from devices, and the other, on the other side, collects things such as fingerprints, DNA, and other objects that we have listed here. Both utilize essential preservation techniques, which there's a process here that's coming along. In computer forensics, digital evidence is preserved through secure practices, and crime scene investigations preserve physical evidence to maintain integrity. And you'll hear this word again as we progress in the presentation. And that's just like the computer forensics experts, integrity, remembering that. We will discuss how the foundation, the fundamental investigative concept must maintain a chain of custody and analyze and examine procedures and adhere to legal protocols and standards. Investigators must maintain the expertise and experience as a requirement to accomplish these tasks. Okay? That's important. So these are similarities, whether it's on the digital side or this physical side, what these investigators have to go through. What is the role of digital evidence investigation? Digital evidence is now an indispensable tool in modern investigations, playing a major role in uncovering the truth and securing justice. In the digital landscape, every click, message, and interaction leave a trace, offering investigators a mound of clues that traditionally may have been overlooked. Analyzing digital evidence is the key component in criminal justice on the investigative or the investigative fields. The importance is to further outline presentation methods, which, unlike physical evidence, they can deteriorate. Digital data remains relatively stable and can be recovered even after deletions. And we will see some of that later on. And this analyst of data, digital evidence reveals patterns, connections, and timelines, helping investigators piece together the piece of the puzzle. So we can see through digital evidence, there's email, right? We know a lot of us utilizes email. Photos, videos, social media posts can become powerful testimonies that can strengthen the prosecution when presented effectively in court. Understanding the proper procedures for collecting this material evidence, for collecting, preserving, and presenting digital evidence ensures this is another step that investigators have to go through, admissibility in court, and deemed included or excluded due to error. That's an important part of getting to the part where you need to present this evidence and have it being able to be presented. So this leads us to the types of digital evidence. Digital evidence comes in, again, various forms, providing a mass amount of information to reconstruct events. And once again, we see some of the state. Now we're getting more into what we need to do to protect this evidence when we're working in this field as well. There are entities that are out there that are working on both sides, and our national security can be threatened as well. Just things that we need to be aware of when we're working with this field. Okay. So again, what are the types? We see hard drive here, which store vast amounts of data, including documents, emails, history, system logs, and even deleted files that we talked about. Imagine a hard drive as a digital storage unit holding elements of past activity and experiences. We heard that in some of our other presenters tonight. Some of you are maybe familiar with some of these devices and may. We use them a lot, I'm sure, right? A lot of us. And we have the cloud storage platforms like Dropbox and Google Drive have become digital file cabinets storing documents, photos, and backup of devices. This information can offer valuable insights into user behavior and data access. Once again, another great means of the investigative process. Okay. Communication sources. Again, just repeating all this, we have emails. How many of us and how many emails have we sent and received over the years? And we know that emails, written messages, can reveal intent and connection between other people. Think of them as digital letters that you might consider private and personal. How many of you use WhatsApp? A platform that offers real-time communication exchange, potentially capturing conversations and revealing sensitive information. Imagine an intercom, if some of you are familiar with that term, recording your words in text form. What about social media posts? These public and private interactions can provide insights into a person's thoughts, relationships, and activities. Think of a community board where you post, where people post, you know, little cards about wanted items, lost dogs, you know, and projects that they want completed, for example. There's all our sources that are vital to the investigative process. Multimedia logs involved photos and videos. Visual captures can provide evidence of activities and identify individuals and crime scenes, like a digital camera capturing moments in time. Audio recordings are another thing. Voice messages, phone calls, and recordings from security devices and surveillance cameras can provide audio evidence of spoken words and conversations. I think of how my Ring camera can pick up and record audio and video of outside movements, and I'm able to go on to my device and look at those things from months back. How maybe interesting and maybe a little bit troubling in some ways is that that all that information is stored. Right? Look at it in both ways. He steps in an examination. What are they? Well, identification, which involves recognizing potential sources of digital evidence, devices, storage media, network, etc. Well, collection is a step, which involves gathering digital evidence without altering it. So here we come again to maintaining the evidence integrity and using forensically sound methods. This is an important step when it comes to being able to present this information. Right? So, what about examination, which involves analyzing the collected data for relative information by using the forensic tools that are out there to examine files and system activities for unusual patterns? And then we analyze that by interpreting the findings to draw meaningful conclusions. The important step also is documentation, which is very important to being admissible. It involves creating detailed records of the examination process. The information should include procedures, tools, used findings, etc. Then we come to the part where we have to report this information, which includes communicating findings clearly and concisely to generate a comprehensive report detailing the investigation, evidence, analysis, and conclusion. Right? Lastly, the results must be presented to relative parties like the legal teams, court, or investigators, and most importantly, the objective is to ensure that the evidence is admissible in court, which is enhanced by following legal protocols, maintaining, which you'll hear again, a chain of custody. All right? What are the challenges in computer forensics examination? In particular, we'll concentrate in some way on law enforcement. What about all the devices out there, the volume of data that's on them? Consider the staggering amount of data that is stored on a smartphone, right? Gigabytes of information, if you will. A computer today can store, have you heard, and I'm sure you have, terabytes. That's a lot of data. Add this to the complexity of formats and encrypted files to obscure software logs, right? That's another obstacle, encryption. The investigator needs specialized tools and knowledge to access and interpret different types of data when that happens, right? Moving along here, got several information. We can go to old devices, like an old telephone. Some of you might be familiar with that. And then, so we know the evolution a little bit of how devices have developed to where we have come today. Even our televisions are pretty advanced as well. Most of us have in our hands a lot our smartphones. So we add the fact that the framework around evidence is constantly changing and requires law enforcement to stay informed and make adjustments accordingly. Okay? Cloud computing is one big thing today, moving along. Today, more operations are headed to the cloud, which can present a jurisdictional and access issues with data stored on cloud platforms. The impact can transfer to major difficulties, that is, in obtaining and preserving cloud-based evidence for legal purposes. Okay? What did we talk about before? Which is an important element here is chain of custody. Most of you may be aware of the CIA triad, which is the guiding model pretty much in information security. CIA stands for confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Yes. Personal and sensitive information must remain confidential. I mean, that's clear, right? And protected from unwanted sources for various reasons, legal, moral, ethical. For customers, data must be available when needed. That's availability part of it, right? For what we are now, we need to shine the light on integrity. Integrity, the integrity component, which is the main ingredient in the chain of custody scheme. What is the chain of custody in digital forensics? It primarily ensures evidence integrity. It is the meticulous documentation of every step from the moment digital evidence is seized to its presentation in court. So these are all the connections that need to be made for those purposes. Moving along, so I make sure I'm not going over here. Overcoming challenges in computer forensics. The digital crime scene and where we are. The digital crime scene. So let's move on to taming the digital avalanche. What are the challenges? Data volume, we said, and complexity. Modern devices hold terabytes of data, requiring investigators to navigate a sea of information and provide relevant evidence. We have some solutions, tools, techniques, specialized software that will help filter and organize these devices and analyze them effectively, sifting through the relevant cluster to unearth the hidden clues. Checking or cracking cracking the encryption fortress. Okay. We know that the challenge is encrypted data, locked treasure chest of information that can hold key evidence but present a significant battle. Solution, perhaps, is a multifaceted one. Investigators utilize a combination of techniques, dictionary and brute force attacks, systematically guessing passwords, and trying every possible combination to unlock that data. Let's move on here. We need to stay ahead of all of these and embrace and innovation as a solution. Continuously learning and collaborating are key. I know that we talked about in other presentations tonight, training. That's a big part in individual training and certification. Regularly attending workshops and acquiring certifications to stay updated on the latest forensic tools and techniques. Collaboration is huge. Open source tools. Utilizing free and community developed tools or other ways to help with these challenges. Building a bridge of trust. Okay. The legal landscape. What is that? Navigating through a legal and ethical concerns. Miscibility of evidence. There are concerns with that. Fourth Amendment and data privacy concerns. We got to be careful what information we present and if we're not violating any of those Fourth Amendment rights, privacy rights. Search warrants and seizure procedure protocols. Those are just, I mean, with law enforcement having to get involved, digital forensic experts, all of these people need to follow these procedures when these information needs to be presented. So that is the real connection here. The chain of custody and data integrity, once again, that must be maintained throughout, where we're not altering that data in any way. So it might be deemed inadmissible. What are the ethical concerns? Privacy and intrusion, potential overreach, some people might do. That be a violation of their personal data. Balancing crime investigation with citizen liberties, okay? Being transparent and accountable in handling sensitive data. Bias and discrimination, we've heard those terms before. Human biases influencing and interpreting and analyzing. We need to be aware of these things. The AI is a big concern these days about whoever develops that AI technology or device, are they subject to these biases and discrimination regulations? Okay. And moving forward with balancing interests, okay? Collaboration and transparency is good. It's huge. Engaging public discourse and stakeholder dialogues, building trust through clear guidelines and communication, collaborating with technologists and legal experts. These are all very good ways of overcoming our challenges. Standardizing protocols and training. Yes. Investing in technology and innovation. All right. That's a real important part of what we need to do. Case studies. There are several. And when I was looking in my research, and I went over one that's called Bringing Down the Silk Road, which was in 2013, meticulous analyst of Bitcoin transactions and IP addresses led to the dismantling of the infamous online black market Silk Road. This landmark case demonstrated how digital footprints can expose even the most hidden criminal operations. Others that I've gone over a lot in my research, and which is a little bit troubling to me, but hopefully we can make some leeway with our advances in technology and evidence and digital evidence these days, and that is combating child exploitations. Computer forensics is a vital tool in combating child exploitation and trafficking. Investigators can use specialized software to track online predators, analyze child abuse imagery, and identify victims, leading to rescues and prosecutions. Yes. What is exploring the future of computer forensics and law enforcement? What does that entail with our crystal ball that we might bring up? Let's look quickly here at the technical landscape. Artificial intelligence, we talked about, I mentioned earlier, vast data sets and identification of subtle patterns, automated threat detection, all these things, potential ethical concerns and bias risk, we talked about that. Internet of Things, challenges in securing and extracting data from diverse systems, new avenues for evidence collection and analysts with all these devices, new devices, the mounds of connected devices we have, refrigerators, television, a lot of things we have, our alarm systems, our security lights, okay, blockchain technology. I won't go into all of this, just to move on here. What are the rising challenges and opportunities and data privacy concerns? Yep, we talked about that. Evolving encryption techniques, quantum computing posing potential threat to current encryption standards. So it's all coming to us these days. These are the challenges and what, how do we overcome it? Investing in post-quantum cryptography and innovative description methods, right? Collaboration is huge. Let's continue to do that as we learn about these processes. Shaping the future. Where are we there when we talk about shaping the future? International cooperation and standardization has been in place and is known to be of some effect in doing this. Ethical frameworks and ethical trust, establishing that, developing clear ethical guidelines for responsible and transparent forensic practices. Engaging in public dialogue and building trust with citizens, ensuring accountability and oversight in forensic actions. And that's, I've gone through, I hope I didn't spend too much time, but do we have any questions? I guess I'll stop sharing.
Good job. Very good. Understandable. Sounded logical to me. Good job. Yeah. Anyone have any questions for David?
No.
Nope. No questions? Okay. I guess no questions, David. But I do like forensics. But my instructor told us, well, if you don't have any criminal, criminology background, then you'll be discouraged from doing forensics. So I thought, oh, I guess I can't. But, you know, that doesn't mean you can't. You never know who you will encounter. And if you are interested in that field, you know, go for it.
I worked in and it's interesting enough to me. I have some interest in that. Uh-huh. At least it seemed exciting to me to sort of break evidential pieces apart and kind of delve into it. I was a probation officer in my past. Also.
Oh, were you? Oh, great, great. Well, you have some background, so that's fine. But yeah, I've always been intrigued with the, the codes and finding secret messages. That part I really like. So I got into stenography. I think that's how you pronounce it. I'm not sure. Where they have hidden pictures or hidden texts in the pictures, that type of thing. But I do like the coding part. You know, when cryptography.
Yeah, that was fascinating for me to find that out. And I learned about a little bit of that more in my class studies coming to Purdue. That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Wow. The hidden messages.
Yes, I really liked that a lot. Because then it was, I remember one assignment we had, and it was really hard to find the information, what they were looking for. But it took a while for me to do it, but I worked on it and worked on it until I actually found those, the secret message in it. So it was a nice feeling going, oh, I got it. Yeah. Because, I hate it when I have an exercise to do and for the assignment and I can't figure it out right away. And so it was challenging, but I really enjoyed it when I got it. So recording.
Cool.
Yeah. But the hard part for forensics is, let's say, you have someone from China or Russian, you know, trying to do something bad in the U.S. That makes it really more difficult, because not only you're talking about a foreigner trying to do something bad in the U.S., but you need cooperation from the country. So if it's from Russia, you'll have to get the Russian, you know, administrators to, you know, let you know about the information or whatever, you know, stuff like that. So that would be a difficulty. And so I'm glad I'm not in that part of it, because that I would not be able to, you know, figure out how to get there, although, you know, people have done it.
Well, yeah, those jurisdictional even challenges, mm-hmm. right? Even right. that law enforcement has to go through.
Yep.
You Definitely. Know, they, right. You can't just go to Canada and say that I'm going to, right? Right.
Right. Right. Because then you have to go through the channels. You know, talk even, to the Canadian officials and all that before getting your man or girl.
Right. Well, you even think about, like, let's law enforcement example, but it I think it transfers to a lot of where a local jurisdiction in the state, who trumps the state and who trumps the FBI, right? A
right.
federal agency.
Right.
So they don't, they can't.
I know.
Federal agency comes in and takes over sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. And things change. So, you know, it's hard to keep track sometimes who's in charge of what, you know. It's difficult. Okay, so it sounds like we have our last presenter. That's Yao's recording. We were supposed to do that last week. Or was it last week? Something like that. Okay. No questions. Good job, though. Okay.
I have to go to my seminar. Sorry to interrupt, but I have to go to my seminar. But thank you for everything.
All right. Take care, Alexis.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye. All right. So let me present. So one moment while I get that set up. Screen. Window. Or is it this one? This one. I think we did that one. And we hit this one. And share. Okay, can you see my screen?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And let me start, and then let me know if you do not hear, but you should. Okay, but let me try this.
Unleashing the power of cloud, navigating modern solutions.
Sound okay?
Exploring the future of cloud computing. Introduction to cloud computing. Good evening, everyone. Today, we embark on the journey into the transformative world of cloud computing. Our presentation, Unleashing the Power of a Cloud, Navigating Modern Solutions, aims to explore the evolution and impact of cloud technology on the modern business landscape. Cloud computing is not just a technology shift, it's a revolution that empowers organizations with scalable and flexible solutions to meet their dynamic business needs. Cloud service models. Let's start by understanding the various service models offered by cloud computing, infrastructures as a service, platform as a service, and software as a service. each modem provides a different level of abstraction and management responsibility. Choosing your right service modem is crucial for aligning cloud resources with specific business requirements. Cloud deployment modems. Next, let's explore the different deployment modems: public cloud, private cloud, hybrid cloud, and multi-cloud. Each deployment modem has its own set of advantages and consideration, influencing factors such as security, control, and scalability. The flexibility to choose the right deployment modem enables organizations to tailor their cloud strategy to unique business needs. Benefits of cloud computing. The adoption of cloud computing brings about numerous benefits, including cost efficiency and scalability and flexibility and change security. Support for collaborative remote work. Beyond cost savings, cloud computing fosters agility and innovation, transforming the way organizations operate and innovate. Cloud security best practice. Security is a paramount concern in the cloud. Implementing robust practices such as data encryption, identity and access management, and regular audits ensures a security cloud environment. Security is a shared responsibility, and adopting best practice is crucial to safeguarding data and infrastructures in the cloud. Cloud native technology. Cloud native technologies such as containers, Docker, orchestration such as Kubernetes, and serverless computing empower developers to build and deploy applications with greater efficiency and scalability. Embracing cloud native technology enables organizations to arms the full potential of cloud for application development and deployment. Case study, successful cloud implementation. Let's start a closer look at real world example of organizations that have a successful implement cloud solution. This case study provide insight in the best practice, challenges faced, and transformative impact of cloud technology. Learning from successful implementation help us understand how organizations leverage the cloud to drive innovation and achieve business objectives. Feature trends in cloud computing. As we look to the future, several trends are shaping the landscape of cloud computing, edge computing, AI, and machine learning integration, and the potential of quantum computing in the cloud are key area to watch. Staying informed about emerging trends ensures organizations remain at the forefront of technological innovation in the cloud. Conclusion. In conclusion, the cloud is not just technology. It's a catalyst for innovation and transformation. As we navigate the evolving landscape of cloud computing, let's embrace its potential to reshape industries and drive progress. Question answer section for humanity. I would like to open the floor for questions. Feel free to ask about my any aspect of cloud computing and relate topic. Your engagement is crucial to making this session enriching for everyone. Closing. Thank you for joining me on this exploration of cloud computing. I look forward to the opportunity to delve deeper into this topic during the masterclass. Those are my references of my research.
Cool. Any questions? I guess I can't answer for him, but I do remember the topic. We had to do similar. We had to talk about cloud computing, I remember, doing one of my presentations for one of my classes. All right. Any comments? No questions, no hope. I'm just teasing. All right, so everyone did a good job. And I do like some of the pictures that Yao had on his slides. Look really intriguing or interesting to have there. All right, so no questions or comments, huh? All right, so I guess you can go because we're done early because we did have a couple slots open. Did anyone want to do another do a presentation? Because I noticed there are some more that joined us, so I thought maybe I'll suggest that because I think Marjorie asked about if there was anyone who wanted to, come in today and do their presentation, then they don't have to do it at a later time. It's up to you. So no other presentations. Okay. Well, I'm going to end it then, and you kids are dismissed. If you want to stick around, that's fine. But I'm going to stop the recording.